Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harpsong for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs. Oh, pretty sure I have that fan up too high. Okay. All right, we are on page 24, chapter 6. President Thomas Jefferson, who had been into office at the same time as the young Tsar Alexander I's reluctant ascension to the throne, had been very grateful to this new ruler for having come to the rescue of one of our frigates when, during the period in which Napoleon was doing violence to the laws of nature, it had been stranded on the coast of Tripoli. President Jefferson had expressed his sense of exalted pleasure in the various acts the Tsar's administration had achieved during the short time he had been on the throne in his country, all seeming to flow from virtue and wisdom. To be sure, President Jefferson had been riding at a time when history seemed not the stumblings of blind gods or blind fate, but an exercise in the principles of morality and immorality. Man had a choice between forward and backward movements, sound principles pursued with a steady step, dealing out good progressively as your people are prepared to receive and to hold it fast, cannot fail to carry them and yourself far into the improvement of their condition during the course of your life. Alexander I had been attracted by such spirits of reform as a wildly eccentric utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham, to whom when the old hermit was living in splendor as a tenant in the manor house Ford Abbey near Chard in Somerset, its surroundings so resplendent that they might have been a miniature palace fit for a czar, he had sent a footman bearing a diamond ring in a box, which was returned to him with its seal unbroken, for what the old hermit had wanted was to codify the Russian law for the Tsar. Among those potentates who had come to Bentham for help with the constitutions of the republics that they hoped to build were Aaron Burr, with his dream of establishing an empire in Mexico, and General Miranda, with his dream of liberating Venezuela. Alexander I had also been attracted by Robert Owen's new view of society. At a convention of kings in Frankfurt, he had been approached by this great propagandist of a classless utopian society, who had not yet found a place for the demonstration of his ideals, and who had offered the Tsar a copy of his scroll for which he had no pocket. The Tsar had invited Robert Owen to come to his rooms at some later date for a discussion of spiritual redemption, a subject of the greatest personal concern to one whose political advisers included the spirits of the dead. At this time, the discrowned Emperor Napoleon, who was exiled upon the lonely islands of St. Helena, or who was dying of cancer of the stomach, his eyes almost blind, was said to be reading a copy of Robert Owen's new view of society while still considering the old. The Tsar of all the Russias, with his mind seeming permanently befogged, his broken beams, his lack of any true sense of direction, his desire to retire, had been attracted not only to Benthamites and Owenites, but to the teachings of Charles Fourier, who was considered by many to be a forerunner of Robert Owen, a rival, whom he himself had always considered as the usurper of that utopia upon which he alone should have the patent rights. What had held Tsar Alexander I up to the enactment of reforms that should be carried out not only in spirit but in substance had been not only his betrayals by Napoleon, who had robbed Alexander of his peace of mind and engaged him in war, but also the objections of the conservative vested interests in his own society, who were not interested in the release of the serfs who were his children, or as they called themselves, his little pigeon souls, and depended on him for the least grain of corn they might find on a harvest ground that had been swept bare by the rich landlords. The Tsar began to feel quite early that he could not trust any of his living advisers, that all were scoundrels. They would soon make of him, if he did not take care, a dead pigeon soul in the snow. Alexander I's own historian had warned that Russia had been founded by the autocracy and that it would be disastrous to try to modify its structure. Our political principles are not inspired by the Enlightenment Encyclopedia edited in Paris, but by another encyclopedia infinitely more ancient, the Bible. Our czars are not representatives of the people, they are the representatives of him who rules over all empires. The emperor is our living law. He had clung less to the ideals of the often split radicals who were attempting to achieve the harmonies of universal reform, and more to the Bible as time went on. In thinking over his Book of Kings in March 1810, the former President Thomas Jefferson had remembered, in his retirement at his Monticello farm, the inadequacies of the various kings who had come before either his magnifying glass or telescope. The King of England was a cipher he had written to his old fellow revolutionary John Langdon. The crowned heads of Europe had been weakened by their interbreeding, just as cattle would have been if kept on the same barn, in the same barn, and begetting their calves only by each other. They would have produced animals who were all body and no brain, like the present royal heads over whom Napoleon, it seemed, had triumphed. Among those whom the retired president considered to have been fools were Louis XVI, the King of Spain, and the King of Naples, the Queen of Portugal, the King of Denmark, and the King of Prussia, the latter a mere hog in body as well as mind. These animals had become without mind and powerless, and so will every hereditary monarch be after a few generations. Alexander, the grandson of Catherine, is as yet an exception, but he is only of the third generation. His race is not yet worn out. Alexander's death, which had purportedly occurred in December 1825, was a study in ambivalences just as his life had been. He had apparently preceded Thomas Jefferson to his grave by only a few months, the sage of Monticello having spent his life in opposition to the rule not only of foreign kings, but of American moneybags who flirted with the idea of putting on crowns and coronets, and who, as their power increased, would often be likened by anarchic socialists to such sleek, fat hogs as often did turn down the canyon of Wall Street. Thomas Jefferson is shown by his last letter on earth, which was written by Roger Waitman, librarian of the Patent Office in Washington, having convinced of the justness of the American Revolutionary cause, which had brought to this country a half century of peace and prosperity achieved by refusal to submit to the sword of a king. The mournful Alexander I, who had been on a tour of the Crimea, had contracted a cold, a chill, and fever shaking his bones, and had apparently died, so far as all that was mortal was concerned, had given up the ghost at Tagalog. 8 days had been required for the news to reach St. Petersburg, and even longer time for the arrival of the corpse in the long coffin, not upright, of which the lid was closed all along the way before entombment, in the burial vaults of his dead ancestors in the Peter and Paul Cathedral, there to wait for resurrection, when it would be seen whether the rumor that the Tsar had never died had only simulated his death by pretending to be dead when he was sleeping with one eye opened for his escape was right. Awesome. Like I said, quick chapters, which I'm actually rather enjoying. Thank you for listening. Bye.